ID, the future. A podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID the Future. Today I'm chatting with Dr. Jay Richards about big questions. Indeed, one of the biggest questions of all. Is there evidence for God, or does science point us away from the idea of a creator? We'll be talking about some of Dr. Richards' work, the new book by Stephen Meyer, and a video clip of one of the most famous astronomers and science popularizers of all time, Carl Sagan. Dr. Richards is the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and executive editor of The Stream. He is author or editor of more than a dozen books, including the New York Times bestsellers Infiltrated and Indivisible, as well as The Human Advantage, Money, Greed, and God. Richards is winner of a 2010 Templeton Enterprise Award, and regular listeners will, of course, recognize him as co-author with Guillermo Gonzalez of the groundbreaking book, The Privileged Planet. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks, Eric. It's good to be with you.
So it's been a while since we spoke. Just wanted to, you know, through the pandemic and everything else going on. So what are you up to recently? What's going on?
Well, I used the pandemic to write a book complaining about the lockdowns called The Price of Panic. So that kept me busy in 2020, co-authored with William Briggs and Doug Axe, who many listeners will recognize. Right. And so that, yes, that sort of kept me busy. And then, you know, now that things are open up, I'm traveling a lot and going to a lot of conferences. All the organizations have packed events into July and August, it seems. And in fact, the Gilder Fellows Seminar, in fact, will be this August. And so we're going to do it virtually again, just maybe, you know, one more time, because it's sort of hard to coordinate these things. But people that are interested in the Gilder Fellow Seminar, which is, of course, named after George Gilder at Discovery, but we focus on free enterprise and innovation and human creativity and the economy. And students actually have free registration. So it'll be held online, as I said, on August 26th and 27th. So anybody that's interested in that should sign up.
Excellent. Yeah. And that's, I know that George Gilder's speaking, Gail Pooley, Scott Powell, and of course you're speaking, and some others.
Yep.
And if you register, I think you can get a digital copy of Gaming AI, which is a short book or monograph on some interesting concepts relating to both the concerns and promise of AI that we hear so much about in the news these days. So encourage listeners to go to discovery.org/events, where you can check it out. And the registration fee is really reasonable. As you said, I think for students it's free, and for others it's a pretty reasonable fee. So again, discovery.org/events. That's August 26th and 27th. So, Jay, I thought I'd take a little bit of a different approach today. We generally focus pretty heavily on the science, but today I want to talk about the intersection between science and philosophy, in particular between science and belief in God.
Yeah.
And also maybe have this a little more of a conversation rather than an interview, so we can just kind of brainstorm together and think through some of these important issues, if that sounds all right.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So, of course, Stephen Meyer recently put out Return of the God Hypothesis, which is getting a lot of press, and he's had a lot of opportunities to talk about that book and the arguments that, in fact, the evidence from science, he argues, points toward the existence of an intelligent, active creator, in a word, what most of us would associate with a personal God. And Steve argues that our best current understanding of the science in physics, cosmology, and biology point strongly toward this personal God. And I know you've also done some great work in a number of your writings on this critical intersection of science and philosophy and what the best and latest science points to. And probably most of our listeners are most familiar with the book that you co-authored with Guillermo Gonzalez called The Privileged Planet.
Yeah, and in The Privileged Planet, I mean, in many ways, for me, I mean, I'll just speak for myself as a Christian, the evidence we talked about in The Privileged Planet, I mean, it's a purely descriptive book. In fact, we don't even really touch on the theological implications of it. But the basic argument is that the rare conditions that life needs in the universe in a planetary environment are also set up the best conditions overall for scientific discovery. So discoverers or scientists find themselves in these tiny little pockets within the universe that are overall the best places for doing science, which is what you'd expect if the universe was designed not just for life, but for discovery itself, as if, you know, basically the capacity for science is built in to the warp and woof of things. And we intended it as a very kind of strictly empirical argument, building this cumulative case. But of course, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, you have this idea that the natural world has this revelatory quality. I mean, Psalm 19, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God.
Right.
That of course, God reveals himself in a special way in history and for Christians in Jesus, the person of Jesus. But there's also the created order is like a book that if it's read properly, you can read through it to the existence and even some of the purposes of its creator. And this idea, this can sound strange to people in a kind of modern scientific context, but in fact, this was exactly the view of virtually all of the founders of modern science. And it seems fairly intuitively obvious that, look, if you think everything's just the result of the fate or these kind of blind forces, there's no reason to assume that the human mind is going to be able to grasp fundamental truths about the natural world, or that there even are sort of coherent truths like that. Mm-hmm. But if you think the world's created by a rational and good creator, then, you know, and is intended to be discovered and maybe even has this quality of a book, at least metaphorically speaking, then that can motivate you scientifically. And so that's why you get, you know, the great founders of modern science, whether it's Galileo or Kepler, you could sort of run through them, very often spoke in this way. And it was probably more controversial to say a few decades ago than it is now, but I think most historians of science recognize this. They recognize that there's this kind of broadly theistic and Christian origin to modern science. And I would say this: the idea that science and materialism are somehow simpatico is a weird and very recent detour.
Right, right. Yeah. And it kind of gives the lie once you understand the real history there to the idea that, hey, if you believe in God or if you're a religious person, that that's somehow a science stopper. In fact, the exact opposite was true in many ways.
No, that's exactly right. And this is a matter of us overcoming the kind of textbook bad history that you get very often in science textbooks and among science popularizers, people like Carl Sagan, who often portrayed the history of science as this war between traditional religion on the one hand and these kind of rational, white jacketed scientists on the other, which it makes for, it's a great story. It just doesn't really do justice to the fact.
So you guys talked, you know, somewhat about the fine tuning of the planetary habitat and the conditions for habitability as it relates to discoverability. How has that held up over the last, 15 years in terms of fine-tuning and some of the things that we see both at the large galactic scale as well as the small scale coming up from chemistry and physics?
It's actually held up really well. In fact, I don't know that there's anything in the book we're thinking about doing a 20-year anniversary edition just to basically to update things. I mean, we've discovered a lot more extrasolar planets, so we can be kind of more specific about, you know, okay, what percentage of stars have planets around them. We know more than we did. We went from knowledge when we wrote the book of just a few hundred extrasolar planets to now a few thousand.
Yeah.
And so there's that. There's a deepening understanding of the kind of feedback processes required for a habitable condition. Guillermo's actually extended the argument now to analyze the best types of planets for doing space exploration effectively. You know, if you think about it, if a planet was too big and the gravity on its surface was too intense, it's really, really hard to get a rocket off the planet, basically. Yeah. And so it turns out that there's a, you know, a sort of size of planet. You need the planet to be large enough to be able to hold an oxygen-rich atmosphere and things like that. But if it's too large, then interstellar travel and discovery is actually really, really hard. So as it happens, you know, it looks like the kind of Earth-sized and Earth-mass planets are right in the sweet spot.
Yeah, this is very timely. We've just had a couple of launches with Branson and Bezos heading to space.
You know, exactly.
Suborbital flights. So this is pretty timely.
Yeah.
Well, great. Good. So today, as we talk about some of your work, and in particular, Steve Meyer's new book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, I want to chat about another astronomer and science communicator. I think you and I are both on a listserv, and someone recently posted a clip of the famous astronomer and author Carl Sagan. Mm-hmm. Which really caught my attention because it was a response by Sagan in a Q&A following a lecture he gave. I believe it was in 1994, a couple of years before he passed away. But the question was essentially about the existence of God. And just for our listeners, I want to mention, you know, I'm not trying to ignore other religious traditions, but we'll approach the discussion today from sort of a traditional Judeo-Christian framework, both because what we and many of our listeners will be most familiar with, but also because in the juxtaposition between religion and many of the atheistic or agnostic arguments against religion, Christianity seems to be the focal point of a lot of the discussion. So that's how we'll approach it today, but don't mean to assume that that's the only viewpoint available. So there's kind of a question and assumption in this question that was posed to Sagan that says, you know, science makes the idea of God less tenable. And this goes back to this historical view that, you know, the more we learn about science, it slowly pushes God to the margin. And even though this lecture was many years ago, I think it still really accurately captures much of the sentiment of the worldview today as it relates to the existence of God, a worldview that Sagan and those like him felt was supported by what the science was telling us. And so just to set this up a bit, it's a view that really runs dramatically in opposition to what you've highlighted in some of your work and what Steve is laying out in his new book. So I thought it'd be helpful for us to step back, understand what Sagan was saying, as he's one of the most articulate and popular figures in this area, and still a very prevalent view that many of us have run across and many of our listeners will continue to run across with friends, colleagues, professors, relatives, and so on. So my goal here today isn't to pick on Sagan individually, but to use his views and this popular video clip as a little bit of a springboard to discuss what we're seeing more and more today and to help our listeners navigate these issues.
Sagan in The Privileged Planet it's in some ways, I guess, our foil in the sense that he's a perfect kind of articulate representative of this view that's called the Copernican principle, which is that, essentially that science has pushed Earth from the pride of place in the center of the cosmos in the pre-Copernican, Aristotelian, and Ptolemaic universe to this obscure little pale blue dot, this little speck of dust in an obscure solar system and in the middle of a weird neighborhood in one of, you know, billions of galaxies. This idea that science, as this progresses, sort of trivialized us, Earth, and human existence. And there's this assumption that, well, of course, in the Judeo-Christian view of things, humans have a prominent position. And so that's what science has done. And so actually in this question that Sagan gets in this video clip, I think that's, he's actually been talking that way, this in terms of this pale blue dot. And of course, in The Privileged Planet, I mean, there's so many things going on here. First of all, it's a misrepresentation of the pre-Copernican cosmology to say that if you're in the center, that means that you're in pride of place. Anybody that knows Aristotle knows that, well, no, actually the Earth is the place where heavy stuff decays. It's not so much in the center of the universe. If you think of center metaphorically, it's at the bottom of the universe where stuff falls and death happens. It's actually the moon and above that are made of this fifth element, this quintessence that's immutable and unchangeable and perfect. And so it's just the history itself, this idea that the center prior to Copernicus meant the most important place, it's just historically wrong. But it also, it confuses this kind of metaphorical way of speaking physical location with metaphysical significance, which of course doesn't follow, you know, but look, metaphysical significance is a subtler idea. And so that's why in The Privileged Planet, we push back against this idea that the Copernican principle, it predicts that there should be nothing unusual or special about the Earth. Anything that's true here must be true at countless times elsewhere. And of course, when we actually do the analysis and look at compare Earth-like conditions to other known conditions in the observable universe, it turns out it's a really, really unusual place. And it's actually really special if you're interested in hosting complex life, for instance. And so there's that idea. But then you can see how this gets tied up in theology, right? So there's this empirical question about, okay, is the Earth unusual or not? Are we unusual or not? And then that broader metaphysical question, okay, you know, what does this mean? Is there a purpose to things, or is everything this kind of the result of these blind processes?
Right. You know, I love that. I think that's a really great point. And I'm looking forward to you guys updating the book because we now have well over 5,000 extra solar planets. I used to follow it actually every day, get on the website, see how it's going. It seems that we've got a few, you know, it's not a huge sample size still, but it's way better than a few dozen or 100 that we have.
Absolutely.
And we're still finding that, gee, there's no place like home so far.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then there was this super famous, I think it was a television series called Cosmos that Sagan helped narrate. And it opens with this, you know, statement, the cosmos is all there is or ever was or ever will be. And I think that really encapsulates part of where Sagan's coming from.
It does. And in fact, it captures the kind of paradoxical character of Sagan because he was, you know, effectively, he was really an atheist or an agnostic. He was at best a pantheist. But notice that in some ways he divinizes nature and tries to divinize science so that he's using, I mean, that a Christian will recognize, okay, that sounds like the Gloria Patri, you know, where you attribute to God eternity. You know, it's God that it was and is and always will be. But Sagan says, no, it's the cosmos that all that is or ever was or ever will be. The other funny thing is that when he said this, you know, I think Cosmos was on PBS in 1980. I was a kid and I can remember watching it. Is that, of course, in 1980, we knew that wasn't even true. The universe hasn't always existed. The universe has an age. If you think the universe has an age, then you're conceding that the universe hasn't always existed. So even when Sagan said that, I often say, whatever your ultimate reality is, whatever you think the fundamental reality is, of course, there's strong metaphysical pressure to say that it's eternal. It's got to be this eternal, unless it's going to pop into existence out of nothing. The fundamental reality has to be the thing that's always existed. Yeah. And so even though Sagan knew as a scientist that the universe hadn't always existed, as a kind of pantheist, one, you know, it still has this kind of religious inclination. He was divinizing nature, which requires that you say that it's eternal. So there's this kind of irony in that statement that I think tells us a lot about Sagan himself.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. And I think, you know, just to be clear for our listeners, Sagan himself tried to distance, you know, his views from formal atheism, and described himself as agnostic. But, I'm kind of with you. I think in practice, his approach here really was equivalent to atheism in practical ways, because if after all, by the three letters G-O-D, Sagan means nothing more than the impersonal laws of nature, which is what he said, then certainly isn't the God of traditional theism. And, you know, Sagan himself wrote that the idea of God as a personal being that sits in the sky and tallies the fall of every sparrow is ludicrous, he wrote. Then it becomes pretty hard to reconcile his view with anything other than a form of atheism. But this pantheism, divinizing nature, as you say, nature is the creator of itself, is really a very interesting view that I think we're seeing a lot more of today.
Absolutely.
It's starting to come out.
Yeah, in fact, I think about C.S. Lewis, who says that that's actually the kind of natural view of human beings. I don't think this kind of arid atheism, first of all, people have strong moral intuitions. Most people, I think, kind of naturally have this sense that there is a purpose to the universe. There's a reason that, virtually all of human history, humans have been religious in one way or the other, I think. But there's a kind of, if you just sort of left your own devices, the thing that's easiest, that you could see it with your senses, right, is nature. And you realize, okay, you don't have control over nature. It in many ways has control over you. And so this kind of, this move to divinize nature, I think it's, you know, as Lewis said, it's sort of in some ways the most natural thing for people to do. That's what paganism is. Of course, in Sagan's pantheism, because there could be a kind of a strong version in which there's really kind of nature is somehow personal, right? Or it's like an organism or something. Whereas for Sagan, when he's talking about God, he's really just redefining the word. He's just basically saying, yeah, it's the laws of nature. Okay, so you're free to do that, stipulate a private definition of the word, but that's not what anybody actually means, nor would they take you to mean that if you were to use God in that way. And so it's a really kind of highly idiosyncratic way of speaking. And it's even as pantheism, it's a really thin suit.
Well, Jay, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I really appreciate you being here to help us with this important topic. If possible, I'd love to have you back to continue our discussion.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of ID the Future. Join us again at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. If you find these discussions to be a valuable contribution to the public conversation about these timely topics, consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.